Thanks, everybody, for coming. This is it's great to see everybody here bright and early on a Tuesday morning after Thanksgiving. This is a neat opportunity for us at CSIS and the Freeman Chair in China Studies to welcome Ambassador Alan Holmer, Special Envoy for China and the Strategic Economic Dialogue. Next month, on December 11th, the third installment of the Strategic Economic Dialogue convenes in Beijing. And so this is a great opportunity for us to get a sneak peek at preparations for that event and see what is taking place there. The Strategic Economic Dialogue, as most of you know, is a process that was convened originally the brainchild of Secretary Paulson, convened originally conceived originally in September 2006. As an opportunity for the two sides, for China and the United States, to get together and prepare for what has been an extraordinary integration of the two economies and try to work out the kinks of the two. And Ambassador Holmer came in really in the midst of the dialogues to take the role of Special Envoy in the spring of this year, and has really seized the reins of this process and really begun to drive it in new directions. The U.S.-China economic relationship, as you know, is fraught with both frictions and opportunities, and riding this bull, as it were, is not easy. That is the task that Ambassador Holmer has taken on, and he's taken it on, as you will see, with grace and good humor. You've got his bio, I believe, but if you've seen it, you know that he has a wealth of history here in D.C., both as a Senate aide to Senator Packwood from back in the day. He worked at a small and somewhat effective agency called the United States Trade Representative as a deputy USTR, a place close to my heart. And he served at as CEO and president of a small and relatively insignificant trade association called the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America until 2005. Took this on at the request of Secretary Paulson this spring, and again, takes it on at a very important time in the U.S.-China relationship. Very anxious to hear his remarks this morning. Thank you very much. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Alan F. Holmer.
Good morning, Charles. Thank you for those introductory comments, and thanks for inviting me today. This is really a terrific opportunity for me and the Department of Treasury to be able to get out our messages with respect to where we see things on the Strategic Economic Dialogue. I think it's particularly noteworthy that CSIS has created a forum about China that merges economic, political, and security issues. And that's a very important service to policymakers, business persons, and scholars. It's also an honor for me to be here with, in the front row, former secretary, former ambassador, former senator Bill Brock, who helped raise me from a pup in international trade back in 1983 and 1984 when he was USTR and I was running the dumping and countervailing duty law program, and he taught me a ton when it came time for us to do the 1984 trade bill, which turned out well, I think, and avoided things that could have been problematic. China's reemergence on the global stage is one of the most consequential geopolitical events of recent times. There's hardly any issue, from trade to national security to climate change, or a place, from North Korea to Iran to Sudan, where American and Chinese interests do not increasingly overlap. Because China is so fully integrated into the global economy, what happens in China's economy affects the entire international community. I should also note, for those of you that are taking notes, you might be able to save yourself a little bit of ink. You can go on the Treasury website when you get back to your office and be able to find my remarks there in their entirety. The U.S.-China economic relationship is entering a new phase. First, U.S.-China economic interdependence is deepening. We need each other more and on a broader number of economic and economically consequential issues. Over the past 5 years, according to U.S. data, U.S. exports to China have grown from $18 to $52 billion, while U.S. imports from China have grown from $102 to $287 billion. Moreover, the United States and China are shaping and being shaped by global energy and environmental trends, which have very strong economic consequences. For example, our countries are the world's largest energy consumers and the largest emitters of greenhouse gases. Clearly, our interdependence is deepening. Second, whereas trade and investment were once largely a source of stability in bilateral relations, they are now increasingly also a source of tension. Such tensions are straining the domestic consensus in both the United States and China on the benefits of economic engagement. When I first became involved in international trade issues with Ambassador Brock back in the 1980s, we didn't have significant trade tensions with China, mainly because we didn't have significant bilateral trade. In a sense, the fact that we have trade tensions today reflects a maturing of our relationship and the rapid growth in bilateral trade and investment. We need to make sure that we manage those tensions effectively in order to keep our bilateral economic relationship on an even keel and in our mutual interests. Anxieties about increasing trade manifest themselves in many ways, which leads me to the third dynamic confronting us, the rise of economic nationalism and protectionism in both of our countries. These sentiments may constrain leaders from adopting policies that are in the long-term interests of the citizens and economies of the United States and China. These three emerging dynamics in our economic relationship, deepening interdependence, a strained policy consensus, and the rise of economic protectionism, are mutual and require cooperative solutions. Now, these three dynamics helped inform the creation of the Strategic Economic Dialogue launched by President Bush and President Hu Jintao in 2006. They envisioned a forum to allow both governments to communicate at the highest levels and with one voice on issues of long-term and strategic importance. In earlier government incarnations, I can remember circumstances where whatever the country was, you would have situations where the Commerce Department would go to a country and say, this is the number one priority of the United States. And the Agriculture Department would go to that country and say, this is the number one priority of the United States. And the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative would go and say, this is the number one priority of the United States. But what we have is a mechanism now that allows us to speak with one voice and to be able to establish priorities and to be coordinated on these long-term and strategic issues. Managing our complex and increasingly interdependent relationship is daunting and requires speaking to the right people at the right time, on the right issues, and in the right way. I learned a long time ago that if you were going to be successful in any kind of negotiation or dialogue, it is essential to do everything that you possibly can to put yourself in the other person's shoes, to try to be able to see the world the way he or she does. That's the way you achieve win-win agreements, ones that advance mutual interests, agreements that will withstand the tests of time. And the Strategic Economic Dialogue embraces that approach. The United States has three core objectives for the SED as a new and leading institution in U.S.-China relations. First, through this framework, we are advancing the U.S.-China economic relationship by establishing new habits of bilateral cooperation. We have embraced a broad agenda that covers cross-cutting economic and economically consequential issues, including regulatory transparency, energy conservation, environmental protection, innovation, food and product safety, as well as important economic issues of exchange rate and macroeconomic policies, market access, and financial sector development and liberalization. Our approach engages multiple and diverse government officials in both countries. It breaks down classic bureaucratic stovepipes that hinder effective communication and impede results, and allows us, as I said before, to be able to establish priorities. And that's what engagement does. It keeps the relationship on an even keel by lessening miscommunication and dispelling misperceptions so common in the history of the U.S.-China relationship. It helps us signal to China that we welcome the rise of a confident, peaceful, and prosperous China. A weak and insecure China is not in America's economic or security interests. So first objective, establishing new habits of cooperation, and in so doing advance our economic relationship. Second, it is vitally important that our policies accelerate the next wave of China's reform and opening process. The pace of China's growth and economic reform has clearly been remarkable, but continued effort is needed. China's top leaders now realize that a key challenge they face is taking the bold policy steps necessary for an economy that is no longer in the stages of in the first stages of economic growth. We welcome the Chinese leadership's current efforts to transition to an economy that is more market-oriented, less reliant on low value-added manufacturing exports, one that depends more on the skills and resourcefulness of the Chinese people and less on material inputs and natural resource consumption. A major risk China faces is that its government won't act quickly enough to take the steps, the policy steps necessary to deal with the economic and social imbalances created by its growth model. Without strong policy adjustments, China's economic growth path becomes unsustainable, as Chinese top leaders have publicly stated. We're encouraging key reforms that will help China manage the blistering pace of its economic growth. These include financial market liberalization and a plan for rebalancing growth. China has proven to the world that it can grow fast, but the key issue now is whether it can grow differently and sustainably, where the quality of the growth is as important as the quantity. Bold structural policies are needed to shift China's growth away from heavy industry, high energy use, capital intensiveness, and dependence on exports, towards greater reliance on domestic demand, production of services, and a greater share of Chinese national income accruing to China's household, to China's households. And to enable these market forces to efficiently rebalance the economy and spread prosperity to all the Chinese, China needs more flexible prices, including a more flexible, market-driven exchange rate. Exchange rate flexibility is also key to allowing monetary policy, the most potent instrument for guiding an economy, to focus on assuring price and financial stability. Also, a key to China's future success will be its willingness to accelerate the pace of its market-based economic reforms. This involves meeting its WTO commitments and going beyond its WTO commitments, resisting protectionist sentiment, and opening up its economy to greater international competition for goods, and particularly services, which will help rebalance the Chinese economy and spread prosperity more broadly among the Chinese people. Now, these reforms are and will continue to be resisted by increasingly influential Chinese businesses due to growing suspicion about U.S. efforts to encourage further liberalization of key sectors of China's economy. However, in my judgment, the greatest risk to China's long-term economic security is not that China opens too fast, but rather that protectionists prevail and Chinese reforms proceed too slowly. So the first objective, establishing habits of cooperation and thereby advancing economic growth, advancing the U.S.-China economic relationship. Second, accelerating the next wave of economic reform. And third, and finally in the SED, we are encouraging China to act responsibly as a global economic power. We welcome China into key international financial institutions, and we're giving China a greater voice in them as well. Since the initiation of the SED in September of 2006, we've supported China's efforts to join the Inter-American Development Bank, the IADB, the Paris-based Financial Action Task Force, the FATF. We've also strongly supported a greater voting share for China in the IMF and the World Bank. Increased participation will allow China to advance its interests in these institutions. But it's also equally important that Beijing recognize the responsibilities of greater participation. China has become a major source of foreign aid for many of the poorest countries. We look forward to working with China as a new and welcome participant in multilateral efforts to assure that foreign aid and lending practices promote sustainable development. This new era in U.S.-China economic relations requires new and dynamic ways of doing business. We're meeting these challenges through the creation of the political space and the institutional capacity for long-term stability in our bilateral economic relationship. Now, I spoke earlier about the importance of these new habits of cooperation. And while habits of cooperation are important, good process does not ensure good results. Dialogue needs to be more than talking for the sake of talking and not give U.S. or Chinese leaders a pass on issues of disagreement. It's about setting priorities, specifying consequences, and fashioning practical solutions. Secretary Paulson refers to signposts and benchmarks along the path toward reform. Is progress occurring as fast as we prefer, or as fast as is in China's interests? No. But is progress occurring faster than would have been the case without the SED? Absolutely. Time after time, U.S. government agencies have been able to draft behind the momentum created by the SED. Examples include a new air services agreement on both passenger and cargo, collaboration on energy and energy security and the environment, moving toward more efficient capital markets, work being done by our U.S. Export-Import Bank and their counterpart in China, and addressing concerns about tainted food and product imports. The SED is also not just an event that happens twice a year at the cabinet level. Rather, engagement is continuous, occurs throughout the year, and with progress being announced throughout the year as developments occur. Finally, President Bush and President Hu have set a positive agenda for strengthening our economic relationship. The SED is a core part of that agenda because it is long-term in its vision, comprehensive in its scope, and immediate in its ability to be able to deal with the most sensitive bilateral economic tensions. As we chart the future course of our economic relationship with China, we would be well advised to remember the words of a foreign American diplomat and chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who said we shouldn't, quote, let the politics of last month or next month affect decisions toward China that go to half-century strategic issues. We shouldn't let the politics of last month or next month affect decisions toward China that go to half-century strategic issues. You all know that the politics of U.S.-China economic relations are intensely dynamic and sensitive in both of our countries. The SED is complex international economic diplomacy. We're tackling some of the most difficult structural challenges in China's economic future and in U.S.-China relationship, in U.S.-China relations. The economic and geopolitical landscape of the 21st century will be greatly influenced by the way in which the United States and China work together. That emerging future requires a distinct vision and effective mechanisms to achieve it. By establishing new habits of cooperation, the SED has allowed both the United States and China to begin to write the next chapter of our strategic economic relationship. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take questions.
How do you want to do this, Charles?
Why don't we take questions from the podium? I'll just I'll call on people, and if you can stand and introduce yourself and ask your question. I'll... Don Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Vester. I understand that in the SED, that's okay. I understand in the SED, lifting equity caps on financial institutions is one of the primary goals and objectives of banks, securities, and insurance companies. Can you tell us a little bit of the color and the status of those negotiations at this point? And are you hopeful that there will be some progress on that issue?
Equity caps is... clearly an issue that we're pursuing in the financial sector. There are discussions that are ongoing now at various levels, both here and in Beijing. I don't think I want to be able to make any predictions one way or the other as to how those are going to come out. I think the financial sector is one area where we have been able to make progress with respect to expanding the scope of business, and expanding flows of capital in and through the QFIIs, the qualified foreign institutional investors, and others. But it is still, as is often the case in these negotiations, we're still a little over 2 weeks out from the SED, and we'll need to see how those conversations play out. And I'm just really not in a position to make a prediction as to how those come out between now and then. But it is an issue that the U.S. continues to press.
Hi, Dan Newman, Inside U.S. Trade. Just curious, you talked about the economic nationalism in China, mentioning in passing the economic nationalism in the United States. I'm curious, while you might be following Senator Moynihan's advice to avoid the caucus next month, the Ways and Means Committee, Senate Finance Committee, some other folks on the Hill seem to be paying attention to the politics of next month and of the rest of 2008. Is the idea that a successful SED might be able to hold off a Ways and Means Bill on currency that the Treasury Department might not like factor into the agenda for this month's SED?
Well, we do recognize that various legislative proposals, be it the Finance Committee or the Ways and Means Committee, and other congressional statements, reflect concerns of some among the American people who feel that the benefits of trade with China aren't spread evenly between our two countries or evenly within the United States. Now, there are proposals that have been considered to which the administration has expressed its opposition. What we have also said in those communications is that the best way to deal, to address economic tensions between our two countries is through vigorous, relentless, effective bilateral engagement. I think it's important that we be able to continue to show the signposts and benchmarks along the way that show that engagement with China does work and is a far more effective way to be able to address this than through unilateral legislation on the U.S. side.
Chris Nelson.
Chris Nelson, Nelson.
Yeah.
looking downfield a bit, and also looking back, but when you started out, and the same many of us did also, in U.S.-Japan trade, and one of the big differences perhaps might be that really from the start, Japan not just sold us things, but invested here, built plants, built auto plants, built electronics and parts plants. So a lot of U.S. jobs were directly created by the Japanese investment.
Do you see China getting ready to try that kind of strategy? Is that do you talk about that with them? Given the politics of now and next year, are we ready for that? You remember all the nonsense about sushi off of naked ladies we put up with in the 80s. What kind of nonsense and or concerns might be coming up with the Chinese over the next year or so on that?
We have lots of continuing conversations with the Chinese about investment in the U.S. and also U.S. investment in China. And I'd like to use the opportunity of your question to be able to talk about both of those. On the U.S. side, we have been very clear in stating that we welcome foreign investment in the United States. You saw the statement made by President Bush in May that was the first such statement of that nature in 15 years. And, for all the reasons, Chris, that you know so well, that is that open investment supports job growth, higher standards of living, brings healthy competition, and also that investment is important. So we will continue that. We also have a process at the Treasury Department which will address issues on a national security basis. But that's probably all I'd say on the U.S. side. With respect to U.S. investment in China, that's also an issue that we talk about and attempting to address the concerns of American companies that face issues like the question we had before on equity caps, issues relating to transparency with respect to either regulatory approvals or licensing, issues on performance requirements or intellectual property rights or limitations on corporate structures. We're addressing both of those, but with a recognition that both of our countries benefit from investment that flows into each of our countries. I might go with some of your members. We have time for a couple more.
Just in the back.
My name is Kaori Ide. I'm with NHK Japanese Public Television. You touched upon food and product safety. Since the last SED in May, there's been numerous recalls of Chinese toys. I was wondering to what extent this would be an issue at the SED and what kind of outcome you expect on this particular issue.
Thanks for the question. Clearly, what we refer to as integrity of trade, consumer protection, product safety, is an issue that we've had in our conversations with the Chinese. It will be an issue that will be discussed specifically at the dialogue that's going to occur on December 12th and 13th. And the focus there being on building quality in at every stage in the process and really continuous improvement in terms of the process. HHS has been negotiating MOUs with the Chinese on food and feed and drugs and medical devices. Those are still in the process of discussion and negotiation. There have been other announcements that have been made over the course of the last time period. For example, in September, as you know, the new work plans by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, including on toys and fireworks and electrical products and lighters. Yes, it will be a subject at this SED meeting and where I think there is progress that's being made.
Yeah. Paulson, a comment on the signposts and benchmarks. Can you say which ones are close to being met or which sort of signposts you're looking for out of this SED? And in particular, on the foreign exchange issue, obviously, that's becoming a bigger concern worldwide, especially with the in regards to the euro. Do you look on the renewed interest by the European officials and their visits there this week on the foreign exchange issue as helpful to the U.S. position, as far as getting China to move faster on their reforms?
You know, I think on the RMB issue, I think it is important that there be further appreciation in the currency in order to be able to address trade imbalances. As you know from paying attention to Secretary Paulson's comments on this, this is an issue that is raised with the Chinese at every opportunity, and in particular, focusing on why moving to a market exchange rate is so important as far as their interests are concerned. And it, you're right, it is no longer just an American issue with us and the Chinese, and that's been evolving over some time period. The IMF has issued a statement, the G20 issued a statement, the European finance ministers, President Sarkozy has been there the last couple of days. They have the EU-China summit that's going to occur, I believe, tomorrow, Chinese time. And I think the more voices internationally that they that there can be to be able to address this issue, I think the better. But in particular, I think it's important that we emphasize to China why it is that this issue is so important from their perspective, and that the greater exchange rate flexibility will give Chinese officials greater tools for price stability and financial stability.
Senator Brown.
I'm Bill Brown. I wrestle with the difference between Japan and China. When we were dealing with Japan, we were talking to not just the government, but Mr. Mori and others. And the investment that we were envisioning was private to private. In the Chinese situation, you have these incredible built-up reserves that are detrimental. And I think that's what's worrying the Congress. I wonder how we draw the distinction that can address that very, very difficult.
That's a good question. It is one that has been addressed to some extent in the recent legislation that was passed by the Congress, and I think those that administer that law in the Treasury Department, that's really outside my lane of responsibility, are going to need to be able to address specifically. Charles, you probably have time for one more question.
Sure. Final question.
In connection with Senator Brock's question, will the subject of moving out of dollars and into other currencies
I'm not aware of that issue being anywhere on the agenda, and I would refer you to the comments that have been recently made by senior Chinese officials, indicating that that is not something that they anticipate doing. Last question, I think.
Okay. Final question. Right in front of
you. Jim Berger, Washington Trade Daily.
Hey there, Jim.
Can you be more specific about what's going to be on the agenda, or is it primarily a carryover of the last meeting? And just a little brief question on the currency. You expect it to increase over the next 2 weeks?
Right.
That's two questions.
Right. Let's see. We said there was one more question. He asked two.
Which one do you want?
So I think I'll respond to the first one, which is, Jim, that I'll try to be at least responsive. Issues that we expect will arise: integrity of trade. These are items we anticipate being discussed at the dialogue itself. Balanced economic development, energy conservation, financial sector reform, environmental sustainability, and advancing bilateral investment. But those are not the only issues that are discussed in the broad range of the SED. And I really, in my remarks, which will be there on the Treasury website, there are just laid out specifically the broad range of issues that we're discussing. Charles, I really appreciate
this
opportunity.
Please join me in thanking Ambassador Holmer at this time.